Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin Rose Show. Today we're going to be talking about distraction and how to be indistractable. But before we get into that, I want to tell you to distract yourself. Jump over to Instagram real quick and follow me up at Kevin Rose, and you can see all my latest and greatest stuff posted there. Would appreciate it. Today's guest is Nir Eyal, and Nir first came out with a book several years ago that in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley, we all purchased and kind of devoured, and it was called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Lots of tips and tricks in there if you were a software engineer or a product designer on how to build software to keep people coming back. I think, you know, several years has gone by and we're all kind of feeling the fatigue of this always-on lifestyle of having, you know, a computer in our pocket that we're checking so many times every single day, jumping around between applications, you know, dozens of tabs open on your computer, and it weighs on you. And what's really scary is I certainly feel that, but I feel like the younger kind of generations that are coming up now, I'll pick on my niece for a second. Sorry, Chloe. She's 16. She's always had a device in her hand since a very young age. And now, you know, you remove that device and it's like, you cut off her arm or like, you know, took away her best friend. And it is like, you know, tears are flowing. Like that is such an essential part of that person. And it's funny. There was an artist that came out and I actually took pictures of people using their cell phones and then photoshopped the phone out of their hands. So they were just kind of like staring down at their hands in this like really numbed out, like zombie like state. It's like, when you see it in that light, you realize, oh my God, like we are hooked to these devices. These devices are ruling our lives. And I have this gut feeling that they're creating kind of a fragmented mind, you know, this idea that we have to constantly be looking for the stimulation. And that means looking for that next hit. Like what is going to give me that stimulation? If it's not my Instagram feed, like screw it. I'm going over to my browser and I'm going to find something on a political news website to give me that stimulation. And if it's not that, then I'm going to check the prices of cryptocurrency and like always having to have something and not being able to find comfort in being still, in being bored. Like just that's all going away. And I fear for what it's doing to each and every one of us. So Nir has a new book out called Indistractable, and he's actually choosing now to focus on how he can help people remove the distraction, regain that control of your attention. And in doing so, choose your life, you know, just don't feel like you're pulled into things, but rather be very thoughtful about the path that you choose going forward. So I'm excited to get into this conversation with him. It's very cool to see him writing this kind of follow-up book to Hooked. And I think there's a lot of insights to be gained here. So this is Nir Eyal. So a book about distraction.
Yes, a book about the psychology of distraction.
I'm really excited to chat about this because I am someone that I definitely suffer from this, where I think that I'm on task and then I'm off doing something completely different. I try to come back and then I go off and do something else and I have tabs that are open that emails never get sent. You know, there's that classic, like you come back to an email that has, it's ready to be sent, but you just left it for some reason and there's the send button sitting right there.
It's as if you've been watching me work for the past 5 years here. This is,
I'm excited to dive into how I can address this stuff. Cause I think so many people these days with all of the attention grabbing kind of devices and apps and things like that, like we are just splitting our attention into so many little micro slices. Like what got you interested in this topic?
Yeah. So there's bad news and there's good news. I'll start with the bad news. And the bad news is that it has become easier than ever to become distracted with all of the, you know, the stuff out there that is so interesting, frankly, right? Like if you're a curious human being, this is a really hard time to be alive because there's so many things to explore out there at the touch of a button or a click of an app, right? They're so easy to access all of these potential distractions. And further, you know, bad news, if you could call it that, is that the world is going to become a more distracting place, not less, right? We're going to laugh about, you know, these good old days when distraction was just social media and email accounts and Slack channels, right? Like, just wait until virtual reality becomes something that's adopted by the mainstream. Then let's talk about how distracting things will be. The good news is that what I learned of the past 5 years writing this book, Indistractable, is that we are more powerful. Way more powerful than I thought we were originally. So my backstory here is I started a couple of tech companies. After my last company was acquired, I had some time on my hands and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life next. And I thought I was going to start another company, but I had a very strong hypothesis of around how to allocate my human capital. It was around this idea that habits would be increasingly important, that as the interface with which we interact with technology shrinks from desktop to laptop to mobile to wearable devices and now to audible devices like Amazon Alexa, et cetera, that there's just less real estate to trigger people, which means you have to form habits or your product or service may not as well exist. So I started to dive into into research around how to build habit-forming products. I didn't find any book that was titled How to Build Habit-Forming Products, so I decided to write one essentially for myself. And then I started blogging about this. I ended up getting an email from a former professor of mine at Stanford at the business school there, and he really liked this model I had built around how to build habit-forming products, and so he invited me to teach a class with him, and then that turned into a class that I taught later on at Stanford and at the design school there, the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. And then that became my first book, Hooked, which the subtitle is How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And back then, you know, like you among anyone understands that back in, you know, 2012, 2014, this time period, the big question was not, you know, about overuse. It was, how do we get anybody to care, right? It was, I have this amazing technology. Nobody's using it. How do I get people to use my product? And so that's really the market I was trying to address, were these, you know, fellow entrepreneurs like me who had struggled, you know, banging our heads against the wall, trying to figure out, I made this amazing product. Why isn't anybody using it? And so that's really what Hooked was for.
Yeah. I love the book, by the way. I know I told you over email, but I read the book. It was great.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. And it's been a fun ride, you know, helping companies build habit-forming products. A misconception is that I wrote the book for Facebook and Google and Twitter, and I didn't. Those are the case studies with which what I was trying to do was to democratize these techniques so that all sorts of companies could use the same tactics for good, right? To help people build healthy habits in their lives. And that's exactly what we've seen since the last 5 years, since the book was published. So, okay, so that book, you know, was out, it was doing great. And, you know, 250,000 copies later, it's been a wonderful ride. But then along the way, I found that I was getting hooked myself, and not always to healthy habits, sometimes to unhealthy habits.
What was the point where you said, gosh, this is not healthy for me?
Yeah. I mean, there were multiple points, whether it's, you know, I'd decide, oh, I'm definitely going to exercise today, and I wouldn't. I'd say, you know, I'm definitely going to work on that big project. I know I'm going to do some writing today. And then, you know, 30, 45 minutes later, I'd still be checking email. You know, the list goes on and on. One particular moment in time that stands out for me was I was with my daughter, who was, I think, around 6 years old at the time. And I had I had an afternoon with her, and we had this book of activities that daddies and daughters could do together. And, you know, it was things like make a paper airplane and, you know, different things that you could do together. And one of the activities that the book recommended was to ask each other, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And I remember this one question so clearly, but what I don't remember is what my daughter said, because when she started to answer, I was on my phone. And I'm embarrassed to admit this to you. It's kind of hard to retell this story, but that's what happened. And, you know, I looked up from my device and she was gone. She had left the room. She had gotten the message that my phone was more important than she was. And so that's when I realized, oh my God, like, I know from the inside how these products are built to hook us, how they are designed to be engaging. And if I'm struggling with putting them away, well, lots of people are probably struggling with the same exact problem. And so that's when I started to dive into, you know, so Hooked was about how do you build habits, hopefully healthy habits. So I wanted to get the answer to how do you break unhealthy habits?
I'm curious, going back to Hooked a little bit. I love being like just completely transparent on the podcast as much as possible and trying to encourage people to be vulnerable whenever possible. I'm curious, like, what part of you, because when I was reading Hooked, and I thought it was so great, I was using it to try and, you know, addict more people to the products that I was building. which I look back on now and I think like, gosh, like I should probably have stepped that back a little bit and not been as aggressive. And, you know, do you ever look back on some of the stuff that you wrote then and think to yourself like, gosh, that might be used by the wrong people, you know, to create bad habits?
No.
Not bad habits, I shouldn't say. I should say like just like yeah. super addicting. You know, like you said, like a great point was like the thing you were doing on your phone probably wasn't a bad thing that you were doing. It wasn't like you were like, you know, looking at something horrible. It was like you were probably just engaged in something else. Like but it took time away from your daughter. Like do you worry that people are designing these products in a way that can, you know, suck us away from other real life activities?
Yeah. So I went full circle on this. So originally, you know, again, but you remember back in the day, like, you know, 2012, 2013, like nobody was thinking about overuse per se. That really wasn't people's problem. The problem was, how do I get people to, I have this amazing technology. It'd be great if people started using it.
Right.
And so that's really who I wrote the book for. But then when I noticed that, wow, this was actually going overboard a bit here. And I knew this from the beginning, that there is the potential for a product to be overused and abused. A few things happened. One, I originally thought I would write Unhooked. That was going to be the original title of the book that today is called Indistractable. I thought I was going to write Unhooked, kind of like this, almost like mea culpa of, you know, technology is actually really bad. You need to put it away, because that's what every other book told me. Like So when I write a book, I have lots and lots of book ideas, and most of them never make it to print, because the first step is to research everything else that's been written on the topic. And if I find the answer to the question I'm struggling with, then I don't write that book because it's already been written. But sure. In the case of Hooked, for example, there was no book about how to build habit forming products. I didn't find it anywhere on the shelf. So I decided to write it. And so when it came to what I thought would be Unhooked, you know, originally every other book said, the problem is the technology. The problem, you know, addiction comes from the product itself. And turns out the more I read into what is really going on and got past the surface level analysis and tried some of these tactics. Like basically every book on this topic, I have a shelf full of these books, and they all basically say the same thing. That the problem is the technology. The problem is the distraction. Put the technology away. Do a detox, a 30-day cleanse, digital minimalism, right? They all basically say the same thing. And I tried it, and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is for the same reason when I was obese. I used to be clinically obese at one point in my life. And I would go on all these fad diets. And I would say, okay, 30 days, no fast food. And then, of course, what happened on day 31? Right? I'd make up for lost time. I'd eat everything I could possibly find. And that's why I kept yo-yoing. Because what I wasn't doing was looking at the root cause of why I was overeating, why I was out of control. And it turns out it wasn't the food doing it to me. It was that I wasn't understanding the role that food was playing in my life. And so this is the icky, sticky truth that I came to uncover, and why I didn't write Unhooked, because it turns out there's nothing in Hooked that I want to negate. There's nothing that I don't think is true. In fact, we just finished the 5-year edition, and I stand by the book more than ever because the examples still hold true. What I think is there's a misunderstanding around, and I write about this in the book, but unfortunately I put it in the back of the book, and maybe I should have put it in the front of the book, is that addictions are not the same thing as habits. That an addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. A habit is simply a behavior done with little or no conscious thought. And we can have good habits as well as bad habits, but addictions are always bad. And so I would never want people to create addictive products. By definition, that's unethical, right? To hurt people.
Do you think people create addictive products today?
Sure. And there's many industries I won't work with that have reached out to me. You know, the gambling industry, the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry. I mean, I've gotten many solicitations to work with these companies, and I won't work with them because their businesses wouldn't work without addicts. And there's a big, big difference between a company that depends upon addicts versus one that creates addicts as an unfortunate byproduct. The thing is that, Kevin, anything that is an analgesic, anything that stops pain, if it is used by a sufficiently large number of people, will be abused. Somebody will get addicted to it. So if you think about a product like Facebook, Is it potentially addictive to someone? Absolutely. And if you're servicing 2.5 billion people, somebody is going to become addicted. Mm-hmm. But does that mean everyone becomes addicted? Absolutely not. I mean, look, lots of products are potentially addictive. Many of us drink a glass of wine with dinner. We enjoy having sex. It doesn't mean that we have, you know, that we're alcoholics and we're all sex addicts.
Yeah. This is what I was trying to get to.
Yeah.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so you know, the more I study the science of addiction, it turns out that there's a lot more to the science of addiction. And we still have this, I think this is a relic of the 1980s, right, where Nancy Reagan said, just say no. And the problem has to be with addiction. The problem is always the substance. And that's ridiculous. I mean, it's ironic in a time when so many states are legalizing marijuana that we are, at the same time as we're legalizing cannabis, we're regulating technology. And it's ridiculous because, you know, I used to say that I used to tell crowds that, hey, be careful, technology is the cigarette of this century. And that is a terrible metaphor. Technology is not like a cigarette at all because there's no substance. You know, we're not freebasing Facebook. We're not injecting Instagram. There's nothing that crosses the blood-brain barrier. If anything, technology is like cannabis. Why do I say that? Because cannabis, we all know, the psychoactive substances in cannabis, THC, has nothing addictive about it. It is not, has no addictive properties, unlike nicotine, which does. Yet, how is it that 9% of people who use cannabis have what's called a cannabis use disorder? 9%. How can it be that 9% of people are getting addicted to something that is not addictive? How can that be? Well, because addiction is never about the substance. Addiction is about the confluence of the person, the product, and their inability to cope with pain in a healthier manner. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of evidence that shows that this is the case, that, you know, fentanyl, we know fentanyl is perhaps the most addictive substance on earth today, right? When you hear about stories about the opioid crisis, you hear about people who are overdosing on fentanyl. And yet, literally millions of women are given fentanyl when they go to the hospital and have a C-section.
Sure.
But they don't all become addicted. Only a tiny fraction ever become addicted. So there's more to addiction. We need to get rid of this 1980s mindset that drugs are bad and drugs are bad. It's not just about the drugs. And therefore, it is also not just about the technology. There's something else going on. The root cause is not the drugs or the technology or the booze or whatever. The root cause has something else going on. Much more interesting, I think, than just blaming it on big, bad technology.
Well, do you think that the form of addiction that comes from technology is distraction from your thoughts? Because if I think about a hardcore gamer that's playing video games, like the whales that are out there that spend so much money on these games, mm-hmm. Or even when I created Dig back in 2004, we had this hardcore group of diggers that, you know, were some small percentage of our population that would come in and just use the site for, you know, 10 plus hours per day. And they were just like dig where we thought they were bots. They were digging so many different stories and they were absolutely addicted to that feeling right. of like watching that number go up and that idea that they would somehow be, their name would be in lights on the homepage of the site, like things like that. Is that because it takes their mind off of other things? Is that because they're now able to focus in on something that is not, for lack of a better word, that kind of pain that they were feeling elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So all addiction has the similar root cause, which is the desire to escape an uncomfortable reality, mm-hmm. right? That is nobody stumbles on a heroin needle and oops, becomes a heroin addict, right? It doesn't work that way. There's always something they are trying to go into what's called the zone, right? Whether it's the machine zone from online gambling or, you know, gameplay or web surfing, there's this zone where you can't feel your problems. You can't feel pain. And to some people, despite the negative consequences, and we all do this to some degree, by the way, if we watch a movie on Netflix, we zone out, right? There's something fun right. about that. But for most people, when they see harm done, when they say, oh my gosh, I've spent too much time watching Game of Thrones or whatever it might be, or too much time video gaming, the vast majority of people, we're talking 95 to 99% of the population, do something about it, right? They dial back, they moderate their use. Mm-hmm. A small percentage of people who turns out has a predilection for addiction, and there's almost always, from every expert I've talked to, always some kind of other comorbidity, whether it's OCD, whether it's some other, there's something else going on, a very traumatic life event they're trying to escape from. There's always something else going on. Now, that's why I say that there are two groups of people that I think tech companies do have a responsibility to protect. The first is children, right? That there's many things that I wouldn't let my 10-year-old daughter do, right? I wouldn't let her walk into a bar and order a gin and tonic. I wouldn't let her saunter into a Las Vegas casino and you know, play blackjack, right? She's not ready for that. I also wouldn't let her, by the way, walk into a library and just listen, you know, read any book without me knowing what's in that book, right? Lots of things that she's not ready for. Mm-hmm. Two, the second category of people that deserve protection are people who are pathologically addicted. So this is something I've been talking about for the last, 3 years now. I published this in The Atlantic, but unfortunately didn't get too much attention, and I'm hoping to bring more attention to this idea, is that companies today need what's called a use and abuse policy. They need to give us some kind of number of hours spent time on site, some kind of metric that would indicate that they are going to reach out to people who may be struggling with an addiction. So the silver lining of all this data that's collected upon us today is that for the first time, companies making products that are potentially addictive can do something about it. So for example, you know, if you think about alcohol, the booze manufacturer, they don't know who the alcoholics are. They don't have any personally identifiable information about those people. And so there's nothing they could really do. However, these companies that collect data on us, they know exactly how much we use. And so what I advocate for, and I've met with Reddit and Facebook and Snapchat and Google, I've met with every single one of these companies advocating for this, and they tell me they're working on it. I'm starting to lose patience, frankly, but they tell me they're working on it. This might be low-hanging fruit for regulation that actually makes sense. What I advocate for is for people who are, you know, really in the top 1 or 2% of usage. We owe them, because we know that there's a likelihood that they may be struggling with addiction, we owe them the responsibility of reaching out and saying, hey, can we help? Here are some resources. We see that you are using this product in a way that might indicate you're struggling with an addiction. Can we help? Here are some resources.
That's a great point, because these are actually measured, right?
Exactly. We measure this. We know.
So Facebook knows the people that use it more than, you know, 3-4 hours a day. They know the people that are using it 10 plus hours a day. And I'm sure there are some, right? So at that point, you have to draw a line and say, okay, anyone that crosses or meets this threshold is then presented with a different set of options or cool down period or something that addresses this and really helps them, you know, with some resources. Like you said, that makes complete sense to me.
Yeah. And you know, they actually followed up with me. You know, they told me, Facebook in particular said, okay, we did what you said. And, you know, some people wrote back and it turns out that they're just in very rural areas and their only connection with other human beings within a 3-hour drive is Facebook. Are we supposed to kick them off? And so my reaction wasn't, no, I didn't say kick them off. I said, we need to offer them assistance. I don't think Big Brother should be here saying, put down your phone. I don't think anybody wants to live in a world where companies, you know, intentionally cut you off. I think we do need to do is to protect ourselves as people in the technology industry from being complicit when we know someone is addicted. Then we have a responsibility to reach out with a good faith effort to say, how can we help?
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, it's like I think about someone like my mom who's in her late 70s and she's, for her, it's like at nighttime, you know, there's nobody else around. She's sitting there. And for her to go and spend 5-6 hours on Facebook is kind of like her thing, you know, and that's where she finds her enjoyment. Yeah. And so, you know, just picking some arbitrary line and drawing it, it's really challenging because for her, that's like her communication with other people, right? She's not getting outside of the house.
Absolutely.
So I can see that point of view as well.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that's a terrific illustration of exactly the point. And this is why I think it's so dangerous to vilify technology the way I think we're seeing today. You know, the public narrative these days is that technology's bad. And it sounds very much like, you know, drugs are bad. Like the same type of that teacher on South Park that always says that without understanding, you know what? Well, like a lot of things in life, it's actually complicated. It's not so simple, right? Simple minds look for simple answers. And so it's not quite that simple. Frankly, look, if you are someone who doesn't have a lot of connection with other people, would I rather spend 5 hours a day, which is the amount of time the average American looks at television? Would I rather have you spend 5 hours watching Fox News? Or would I have you rather spend 5 hours interacting with like-minded people online? At least you're interacting with human beings in some format. So for many people, these technologies are a godsend, right? They're their only connection to other people as opposed to passively consuming television. So it's not that we need to be careful of this moral panic that somehow video games are bad and social media is bad and anything that is entertaining is bad. No, it's what we are trying to do. What I want to advocate for is using them with intent. mm-hmm. that using all of these technologies are wonderful as long as we use them on our schedule, not on the app maker's schedule. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not, the fact is today, look, I know how these products are built. You know how these products are built. This day and age, if you're not prepared, if you don't have the skill set to become indistractable, they're going to get you. They're built so well these days that they will get your time and attention. But that's not to say we're powerless, because I believe we have more power than we know. And in fact, thinking that technology is hijacking our brains, that it's addictive, that it's irresistible. In fact, that's irresponsible to tell people, because it makes it true. It's called learned helplessness. That when people believe, oh, there's nothing I can do, you know, these algorithms, and I'm not saying people say this out loud, do. But this is what we think subconsciously.
I do. I always blame the algorithms for sure. This content is too good. Like,
it's too good. Right. Well, what we're doing, ironically, is that we're giving these companies more power and more credit than they deserve. So the message I want to spread with Indistractable is that the power is within us. We do have the ability to put these things in their place if we know how.
Yeah. So how do you do that? I mean, how does one, like, I'll give you a great example for me personally. I really do like the Instagram Explore tab, and mine has been getting better and better over time. Like, it used to be just a pretty dumb one size fits all tab that, you know, you would see irrelevant content, but now they are really dialing in like my, you know, accounts that I'm not following, or sometimes it is accounts that I'm following, but things that would be potentially interesting to me. And that's, you know, that's great. And I have no problem wasting an hour there at night while, you know, I'm sitting in bed. I shouldn't be doing it in bed, number one. But, you know, they're showing me crazy Japanese poodles that I don't know if you've ever seen these things, but they have the most amazing haircuts and like just like really random shit from Japan that I'm just like, I love this. Like, it's amazing, right? So if you start to go down that and realize like, okay, I could dial this back a little bit. Like, how does one go about controlling their attention? Like, where do you start?
So first, to make you feel better, remember that the time you plan to waste is not wasted time.
So as long as you say this is my allotted time for this particular task.
That's a big part of it. So let me walk you through basically the four steps of the Indistractable model. So I love four-part models. Hooked was a four-part model, and so Indistractable is a four-part model. So I'm going to try and draw a mental picture for you. But in the book, you can see this illustrated, but I'll try and paint the picture mentally.
Yeah.
So imagine a number line that goes from left to right, and on the right side is traction. Right? Those are actions that move you towards what you want, things that you do with intent. Mm-hmm. The opposite of traction is distraction, right? Traction and distraction. Distraction are actions that we take that are not what we plan to do, things that we do without intent, things that take us off track. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can now imagine, so you got a number line horizontally. Now think of kind of like making a plus mark so that the number line is intersected in the middle with two arrows pointing towards the number line. And these are things that influence our actions. Only two things influence all human behavior: external triggers or internal triggers. And you remember this from Hooked. External triggers are all the things in our environment that tell us what to do, right? The pings, mm-hmm. the dings, the rings, all of these things that prompt us to action, prompt us to either traction or distraction. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you get an alarm that says, hey, Kevin, it's time to go work out, well, then that's moving you towards traction. That external trigger is serving you.
Right. And the distraction would be like an email that comes in that says 30% off sale at, you know, this favorite charcuterie place. And I'm just like, oh, I got to go there and check out what's going on. Right.
Exactly. If you check that notification while you plan to be with your daughter, like I did, then that was a distraction because I had planned to be with my daughter and I did something else. So those are the external triggers. So now we have three parts of the model. The fourth part that is actually the most important and where we have to start are these internal triggers. Internal triggers are things that prompt us to action, but where the reason that we act, the cue, comes from within us. It's not on the outside environment. It comes from within us. And it turns out the majority of our distractions actually start from within. So these internal triggers are always what's called a negative valence state. There's some kind of uncomfortable sensation. And in fact, all human behavior, we used to think that human behavior is motivated by the desire to seek pleasure and avoid pain. Turns out that's not true. This is Freud's pleasure principle. It mm-hmm. turns out we now know that's not true. In fact, all human behavior is motivated by one thing, and that's pain. It's all about the avoidance of discomfort. So following this to this logical conclusion, what this means is if all behavior is a desire to escape discomfort, and by the way, let me give you some quick examples. So physiologically, right, if you feel cold, you put on a jacket. You feel hungry, that doesn't feel good, you eat. When you feel stuffed, oh, that doesn't feel good either, you stop eating.
I do cold baths out in the freezing weather, and I also do intermittent fasting. So those two examples don't apply. Okay,
so that's a little bit more complicated, but we can get to that as well, about why you do those things against what your body does. But you would agree. Your body tells you, okay, you're too cold, get warm. You're too hot, get cold, right? Like that's how physiologically how it works. The same works psychologically, right? So when we're, every product that we use habitually also is cued from these uncomfortable emotional states, right? When you're lonely, you check Facebook. When you're uncertain, you Google. When you're bored, in your case, you check Instagram stories or Reddit or Dig or stock prices or sports scores or whatever. All of these things cater to an uncomfortable internal trigger. So following this to where the conclusion here is that if all human behavior is motivated by the desire to escape discomfort, that means that time management is pain management. That fundamentally, if we want to spend our time the way we really want to, right, if we want to do the things we say we're going to do, then that means we have to understand this itch, these uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape with these distractions. And that's the hardest part. This is the icky, sticky truth that nobody really wants to talk about that we kind of touched on earlier, is how do I deal with these uncomfortable internal triggers? That's the first step, master internal triggers. And there's really two ways to do that. You either figure out what the source of that discomfort is, or you learn techniques to cope with that discomfort. And there are lots of techniques to do either of those things. The change the circumstance has to do with, and there's a whole section in the book. You know, I realized when I was writing the book that distraction is not just about the individual, right? I can tell you all these techniques that you should do. However, if you get to work and you happen to work at a place where your boss insists on calling you every night at 10 p.m., then it's really hard to be indistractable, right? So, you know, a lot of it is about fixing the environment in which these distractions occur. So there's a whole section on how to do that. Then there's a whole section on how to cope with these uncomfortable internal triggers, right? How can we, if we can't fix the source of the discomfort, how can we cope with it in a healthier manner? And I don't recommend, I don't call out mindfulness and meditation. Not that they don't work, those techniques do work. It's just that they've been written about ad nauseum. So I wanted to give people some new techniques that they can use that are very, very effective at mastering these internal triggers. So that's the first step.
Before we get to those techniques, I'm really curious, how do you label and understand what these feelings are? Like, I'll give you an example. The number one way I get distracted day to day is via like email most of the time, where, you know, a batch of emails will come in at all at once. I'm supposed to be doing something else, and I see something that is more enticing than the thing that I am doing. So I click on it and move on to something else, right? So how do I know that's not loneliness? That's not necessarily boredom. Like, how do I fix that problem?
Yeah. So every distraction has only three potential sources: either an internal trigger, that uncomfortable emotional state, an external trigger with it, which is something in the environment that cued you to action, or it's what's called a planning problem. And so in the book, I give this distraction tracker, where one of the exercises is to just note where you got distracted. So this is a perfect example, right? You find yourself, checking email when you wanted to do some heavy lifting and some heavy thinking, some focused work time. So the idea is when that happens, you're categorizing them into one of these three things, which leads me into the second step of the indistractable model, which is to make time for traction. So it turns out that 2/3 of people out there do not keep a calendar of any sort, which means that their entire day is predicated based on, you know, their whims or external triggers, what other people want. And the fact is, these days, if you don't plan your day, someone else will. And more so, you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it distracted you from. So this means we need to plan out our day. We need to plan out what it is we want to do with that time. You know, I worked with many people in writing this book, and it was amazing to me. You know, when I talk to people and say, "Oh, I'm so distracted, I can't get anything done. You know, my spouse wants this, and my kids want that, and Donald Trump did this in the news, and I'm just constantly, you know, bouncing around." And I say, "Well, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. Can I see your calendar? What was it you planned to do today?" And there's nothing on it, right? Like, it's just white space. So the second step here, after we master our internal triggers, is to make time for traction. And this is advice you probably heard before about like putting time in your day. But it goes a little deeper than that. What we have to do is to turn our values into time. you know, I was talking a good game about this value of wanting to be a good father. But when it turned out, I would make time for my daughter when it was convenient, right? Whenever I had time left over. Well, mm-hmm. I don't do that anymore. That time is reserved in my calendar as it is for everything I need to get done for myself, for my relationships, like the one with my wife, as well as in the workplace. And so that's an important step. We also have to synchronize our calendars with our colleagues, with our spouse, with our relationships, so that we are synchronizing our day to make sure that we have made time to live out our values. So that's a very, very high level overview, but that's the second step here. So for you, for example, when it comes to your email checking habit, I would ask you whether you have time in your day to check email. So for me, I have every Monday is my message Mondays, where I have 4 hours of nothing but clearing out my inbox. Then every other day in my calendar, that's not Monday, I have another hour and a half held for checking only urgent messages. And so this is a technique I talk about in the book about using labels. You know, one of the reasons that email is such a pernicious habit-forming product is that it's not so much the checking, it's the checking and rechecking and rechecking and rechecking that's the problem. That's where it turns out time mm-hmm. studies show we waste so much time on email. Because we forgot how urgently every email needs a reply to. So we keep opening them again and again and again. So one of the techniques I talk about in the book is about only touching each email twice. The first time we open the email, we label it not by the topic. A lot of people use labels incorrectly. They label it by what it's about. I don't think that's the highest valued use of labels. What we need to do instead is label it by when it needs a response. In my case, I label everything either tonight, meaning I'm going to get to it today if it's super urgent, or this week. And if it's labeled with this week.
How do you label it, by the way? What do you have, like the Gmail label? What are you doing?
I use Gmail, but you can do the same thing in Outlook or any number of other programs.
Okay. So you actually apply a label to it digitally, like in your email app.
Yes. Yes. So every, I'm looking.
Okay. I didn't know if this was like a mental label or like an actual, so you are assigning a label to it in the app.
Exactly. So, you know, it's this color-coded label. It's either red or yellow. Red is tonight and yellow is this week. And then I can very quickly, I never have to touch that email again until the time in my calendar that has been allocated for either urgent emails or emails that can wait till the end of the week. And of course, emails that don't need a reply, just delete. So this plan works if you have time in your calendar to do that, right? To do these tasks as mm-hmm. well as time. You know, I schedule stuff that people think is esoteric, right? I schedule time to have breakfast. I schedule, you know, anything that takes more than 15 minutes is in my calendar. And so that's a huge step. That second step of make time for traction.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you, when people come back to you and say, okay, that sounds, well, there's two things that I can think of that I would personally have problems with that I'd love to get your input on. One would be if you have, you're working with someone, let's just say you have on their gym. Gym's very important to me. I want to get an hour workout in every Monday afternoon, right? But a meeting runs late, or my boss calls me in to chat about something else, or I have too much of, you know, life happens in real time. What do you do at that point when you've missed something? Like, my second question is, how far out do you plan? Is this something mm-hmm. where like you look at a calendar and you got a month already pre-planned? Because a lot of people's schedules are pretty dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah. So great questions. I'll answer the second one first. So you want to plan out as long as your schedule is relatively certain. So for example, some people literally go to work every day and every day is different. So they might want to do what's called a stand-up meeting, right? Where you stand, you have this quick meeting with your coworker, or with your boss, your whoever it is that you whose time you need and whose time and whose your time they you owe to, and you're synchronizing your schedule on a daily basis. For the vast majority of people I've worked with, and for myself, our schedules are relatively the same week over week. So once you make a weekly calendar template, and I have a tool that you can use online to help you do this, you just make a calendar template, and that becomes your ideal schedule for the week. And so I keep this template week after week. It took me maybe like 30 minutes to make it the first time. And now every Sunday in my calendar, I have just 15 minutes to review the week ahead. So the idea is, remember when we talked about the distraction tracker earlier, how all distractions are either external triggers, internal triggers, or planning problems. When we look back at the week previously and we say, oh, wow, we got distracted here. We went off track there. I was interrupted by my boss here. The idea is we look at the week ahead and we determine whether we should adjust our calendar to make it easier to get traction in our day. So for example, if you see, you know what, I budgeted an hour and a half every day for email, and I didn't get through my daily urgent emails. Well, now I can adjust that template for next week to in- increase the amount of time I have for that task, right? So it's not that being indistractable means you never get distracted. Being indistractable means you strive to do what it is you say you will do, right? It means you are on path to constantly refining. Right? You're constantly looking back at the previous week and making the next week better by understanding why you got distracted. And then you're either adjusting your calendar, you're taking steps to remove those external triggers, or you figure out, oh, you know what? Actually, the reason I got distracted, which is the number one cause of distraction, was because I was bored, stressed, anxious, right? That's why I was looking to do one thing as opposed to doing something else. What are tactics I can use for each of those three reasons that I might get distracted?
And when someone misses something that's really important to them, like, do you have makeup time? Like, how do you deal with the missed gym appointment?
Yeah, I would say don't cram it in. Try and follow the schedule that you plan for yourself the next day. And then at the end of the week, for example, I would say, okay, I missed that gym day. Why? What happened? Was it something, let's say it was an internal trigger, right? So I overslept. Okay, I didn't feel like it. That's the number one reason that I didn't work out for a very, very long time was that I just didn't feel like it. Because working out kind of sucks. It's hard, right? It's difficult. At least if you're doing it right, it should be hard. So I could learn tactics to cope with that particular internal trigger if that was the reason I didn't go to the gym. If I didn't go to the gym because of an external trigger, let's say I got a phone call from a client or my kid is sick and I got a phone call that says, hey, I have to do something else. Okay, well, that's an external trigger that I can learn how to deal with better next time. Maybe I can have a backup plan so that if this type of situation occurs again, somebody else is responsible in some way, right? Or I can, you know, figure out how to remove that external trigger next time. Maybe it's a planning problem, right? That I didn't make enough time to do that activity. Was it actually in my calendar to go to the gym, shower, and do everything I need to do? Is that in my calendar? Is that the reason why I didn't do it? So by understanding the source of the distraction, we can do something about it the next time around.
And then how do you handle tasks in general? Like when you have, like my laundry list of things that I need to get done is, I like what you did with emails where you're saying, okay, this is either done today or this week. Do you apply something very similar? Because I have, you know, 15, 20 different things. Some of them are bigger projects that I just, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I don't really want to do that. That's going to take a long time. It's annoying, you know?
Yeah. It's terrific.
Like taxes come to mind, things like that. Yeah. How do you stack rank that stuff?
Yeah. This is really a great source of discussion because it's such a pervasive myth that if we just put stuff in a to-do list, that this magical to-do list will get done. And I did this for years and years and years. And I still use a to-do list. But what I think folks don't realize is that that's only half the solution. Because study after study have found that people are horrible at estimating how long something takes. So what we have optimized for by using a to-do list is the output, right? The output is finish your taxes. But that makes no sense unless we have allocated for the inputs. Instead, what you should put is work on taxes for 1 hour and then put that time in your calendar. If it's not in your calendar, it's not going to happen. And so the only metric isn't, did I finish my taxes? The metric should be, did I do that 1 hour I said I would do towards finishing my taxes?
That's brilliant. I love that because then you're getting progress. So that feels good, right? And it's really assigning, it's time bounding something. So you're saying like, I know this might be a 5 hour project and then no one wants to take on, right? Who wants to take on some crazy, you know, boring thing for 5 hours?
Exactly.
But you're just saying, I'm going to do it 1 hour at a time and kind of chip away at it over time.
Exactly. Exactly. Because remember, we don't control the outputs. There's too many exogenous factors, right? We're waiting for numbers from Jim and graphics from Billy. And, you know, like all these other things are contingent on us succeeding on the output. So don't worry about the output. If you just worry about the input, that's your only job. And this is useful in so many domains, not just in our work domains, but also when it comes to personal care and maintenance. So for example, the one of the things I talk about in the book is that I made time every day to sleep, right? So we all know there's extensive science that says you got to get sleep, you got to get sleep, you got to get sleep. And, you know, this has been such a pervasive thought process. And it is true. The research shows you need quality sleep. But the problem is, you know what the number one cause of insomnia is? The number one cause of insomnia is worry about not sleeping. Rumination. And this is what happened to me, right? I'd be in bed every night. I was waking up at 3 a.m. And every night I'd worry about, I'm not getting sleep. And I'm not going to be able to write tomorrow. And if I can't write tomorrow, I can't get my deadline. And I have to give that talk. And I'm not going to be very good on stage. And I would ruminate on the problem. And then I wouldn't get any sleep. So the idea is, well, what happens if you make time for something, right? You do what I tell you and make time on your calendar, turn your values into time. But it doesn't happen. Well, what do you do? And so that's where we go back to this rule of worry about the input, not the output. What I started doing was repeating a mantra. When I wake up at 3 a.m., I repeat a mantra that says, the body gets what the body needs. That it's not my job to force my body to get to sleep. My job is to prepare the environment and do what I say I'm going to do, which is get to bed at 10 p.m., right? That's my only job. Worry about the inputs, not the outputs. And guess what happened when I freed myself from the requirement of sleeping? I started to relax. And of course, you know how the story ends. I started sleeping because I was no longer ruminating. I was repeating my mantra that the body gets what the body needs, and I fell asleep. So that's, and this, you know, this goes in all domains. When I write every day, I can't promise I'm going to generate that amazing idea, but then it's guaranteed if I don't get my butt in the chair and start writing, if I get distracted, for sure I won't produce anything valuable. So the biggest problem is not that that we can't sleep or that we can't create good content. It's that we don't give ourselves the time and place to actually do what we say we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So where does that fall? And you said there's four different things. There's four or five different things.
Four big steps. So the first is master the internal triggers. The second is make time for traction. The third that we haven't talked about yet is to hack back the external triggers. So the reason I call it hack back the external triggers is because, you know, we know that these tech companies, you know, they use what's called these external triggers, these pings, dings, rings, all of these things in our environment to hack our behavior. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that we're powerless. So what I encourage folks to do is to hack back, right? We can modify technology so that it serves us as opposed to us serving it. For example, I love Facebook. And as you know, I have time in my calendar to use Facebook. And I love Instagram as well. I love those stories. I think they're interesting. They're entertaining. So instead of using it the way the app maker wants me to use them, I use them the way I want to use them. So when I go into Facebook, I use a Chrome extension called Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator that flushes out the newsfeed. I don't want to see the newsfeed. I know it's designed to be inflammatory and to get me to keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. What I do like to do is to go to specific friends' pages and see what they're up to. So you can modify these technologies to make them work for you. So for example, we can do a whole lot to remove the external triggers from our desktop, from our phones. I give these instructions on how you can do this in less than an hour. You know, for all we bitch and moan about how distracting our devices are, in 1 hour or less, I can tell you how to make your phone into a distraction-free device by removing all these external triggers that don't serve us. My Marie Kondo type question, you know how Marie Kondo says, does it spark joy? My Marie Kondo question is, is the external trigger serving you or are you serving it?
Yeah.
And so that's what we have to do for our technology. Also, one of the things I learned in writing this book is that when it comes to external triggers, we don't think enough about the non-technological external triggers. For example, you know, we know that one of the biggest sources of distraction in the workplace is other people, right? Mm-hmm. It's open floor plan offices where people stop by and just want to shoot the breeze, right? When you're in the middle of working on something. So this turns out to be a serious source of distraction. Not that interacting with other people is not a good thing. It is, but on your schedule, not on their schedule.
Well, I would call that Slack as well. Slack is a big, big
exactly. Thing. Oh, there's a whole chapter on group chat, how to be indistractable using group chat as well. So I put in the book, actually, this cardstock cutout that you can pull out and fold. It's this big red square that you can put on your screen, on your monitor that says, I'm indistractable right now. Please come back later. This physical symbol that says, hey, I'm busy right now. Please come back a little bit later. So there's all kinds of techniques how to hack back those external triggers. That's the third step.
Yeah. I got to tell you, one of the things that I immediately did, well, actually, this is a great story. I got the first edition Apple Watch when it came out. I was like, that thing's cool. Like, I'm going to check it out. You know, I'm a geek. So I bought one. And I first thing I noticed, it was just filled with, you know, notifications. It was just buzzing all the time. Every time I got a text, every time anything happened, like they turn all that stuff on by default. And then I put my Apple Watch in a drawer. So I'm not wearing this thing. It's just too distracting. But later I went back and I modified all the settings, turned off everything. And the only thing that comes through now at all is phone calls, which is nice because if you don't have your, first of all, not that many people call you anymore. And if you don't have your phone nearby, you're aware of something like that happening and then you can go run and grab it, right? So I think that just being able to go in and modify that software and really taking that time, it does take an hour to go through your phone and all your devices, but it really does help out once you get it done.
Totally. And a few things here. One, 2/3 of people never do that. Turns out studies show 2/3 of people never change their notification settings. Like, how are we going to complain that technology is so distracting if we haven't taken the few minutes to adjust the notification settings? Mm-hmm. And so that's you know, such a simple step that we can all take. And again, it's not that they're all bad. It's not that they're all evil. It's that we have to ask ourselves, which ones serve us? Do we really need to be notified every time someone tweets at us? No, that can wait till later in the day, right? There's not a huge emergency there. And second, I couldn't agree more about the Apple Watch. I actually got an Apple Watch as well, and I don't have it anymore. Now I moved to the Nokia. They bought WeThings, and I love their watch because it only sends me triggers around three things that I actually think are worthy of interrupting me, which are phone calls, like you said, text messages, and the time, right? Like, I want to constantly see the time. So I want a device that shows me the time all the time, because I find that when I check the time on my wrist, I'm less likely to get sucked into the content vortex when I used to check the time on my phone.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the second you look at the time on your phone, you see all those notifications.
Exactly.
So what's the fourth thing?
The fourth step is one that you have to use with caution. And this is called preventing distraction with PACTs. And PACTs essentially are pre-commitment devices. This is an ancient technique. This is actually the first example of a pre-commitment, comes from the story of Ulysses in the Odyssey, where Ulysses, this hero, you know, story written 2,500 years ago by Homer, he binds himself to the mast of his ship to avoid crashing his ship onto the shores of the Sirens Island. The Sirens are these creatures that sing this mythical song, and anybody who hears the song crashes their ship onto the shores. So he enters into this pact, this pre-commitment, to make sure he doesn't do what he doesn't want to do. And we use this throughout, you know, various places in society, right? If you have a savings account that has a penalty if you withdraw before retirement, that's a pre-commitment. Getting married, right? Telling the community about your love for another person and making a vow in public, that's a pre-commitment. So we can use these kind of pre-commitments to help keep us in, as opposed to letting us get distracted. So ironically, we can actually use technology to help prevent technological distraction. So there are three types of these pacts: effort pacts, price pacts, and identity pacts. Effort pacts are ways that we can make the behavior we don't want to do more effortful, more difficult. So for example, when I write and I don't want to get distracted, I use this app on my phone called Forest. I open up Forest. I set how many minutes I want to do focus work for. In my case, let's say 45 minutes. And this little virtual tree is planted. And if I pick up the phone and do anything with it in those 45 minutes, the little virtual tree dies. Now, it's just a stupid little virtual tree. Who cares, right? But it's enough of a pre-commitment, enough of a pact that I've made with myself to remind me, you know, this is not what you want to be doing right now. Mm-hmm. And if I want to circumvent that, it takes more steps, more effort to do something I didn't want to do. That's an effort pact. We can also do a price pact, where we inflict some kind of cost if we don't do what we say we're going to do. And then finally, an identity pact, where this is probably the most powerful of the three, that by calling ourselves a certain identity, we can shape our behavior. So there's some fascinating research about how effective identity change is in behavior change. And this came out of some personal insights. So I used to be a vegetarian for many years, and it was amazing to me how easy it was to not eat meat when I identified myself as a vegetarian. It didn't require willpower anymore. Just in the same way I'd imagine, you know, a devout Muslim doesn't expend willpower thinking, ooh, should I drink a whiskey or something? Or a devout Jew doesn't say, ooh, should I have a piece of bacon? They just don't. It's part of their identity. And so that's where this moniker comes for the title of my book. I want us to start calling ourselves, nope, I'm indistractable. This is why I do these weird behaviors, like put a sign on my screen when I'm doing focused work. This is why I won't return your emails and calls immediately, because I'm indistractable. And I think we need to have this new identity, this new moniker, that we can say with pride, this is the kind of lifestyle we want and what we expect of other people.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that idea of these little things that you can place around you as nice little reminders. One of the things that I do is put a red rubber band around my phone, just because I do so many pickups on the device. Like I looked at my pickups on device and it was like 100+ a day, and just seeing that, I'm like, oh, I probably shouldn't pick up the phone right now. I don't really need to use it. I'm just doing this out of habit, right?
Right.
And it's that subtle little reminder that breaks that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's probably an example of an internal trigger. You know, if you want to take it a step farther, even is to really understand when are those moments in your day that you're most likely to want to reach with your phone out of habit without really thinking about it. What's the feeling that precedes that action? And that's when you can actually stop checking the device altogether. Not just, you know, when you see, there's nothing wrong with a rubber band, of course, it's a great idea, but wouldn't it be interesting if you actually nipped it in the bud and understood why you're reaching for it in the first place? Are you bored? Are you lonely? Are you anxious? What's going on? And how can you either fix the problem or learn to cope with it in a healthier manner?
Yeah. So do you recommend doing just kind of a log for the first week or first few days to really see where you stand? Or how do you assess yourself like that?
Yeah. So I recommend first understanding the first four steps of the indistractable model: mastering internal triggers, making time for traction, hacking back external triggers, and then finally preventing distraction with PACs. And then once you understand these four techniques, and it is important that you do that in order. For example, you know, a lot of people have heard about this idea of pre-commitments or PACs. You know, you make a bet and you say, if I do XYZ, then I'm going to get punished or something. Turns out that stuff can backfire if you don't know some details about how to use this stuff appropriately. And frankly, you know, all of these steps, if they're done in the wrong order, are not going to be effective. You know, I can tell you, remove all your notifications from your phone, but if you haven't dealt with the internal triggers of why you get distracted, something is always going to distract you, right? So this happened to me. I did one of these digital detoxes. I actually went on Alibaba and I bought myself a feature phone. Didn't have any apps. All I could do was text and take phone calls, and I got rid of my iPhone. I bought a 1990s word processor without an internet connection. And I was like, okay, perfect.
That's amazing.
I found the source of the problem. The source of the problem must be technology. So let me get rid of all the bad technology. And it didn't work because I would sit down at my desk to write with my 1990s word processor without an internet connection. And then when I started feeling this internal trigger of stress or boredom as I was writing, I'd look behind me and there's all these books. And you know what? I should probably look at that one book that I've been meaning to read because I think that should be relevant to what I'm working on, right? Or, oh, you know what? Let me just tidy up my desk a bit. You know, they say tidying up your desk is supposed to help you make you more productive, right? So I could do that. That wouldn't be such a bad thing. Or let me just take out the trash. So you can see where this is going. I kept getting distracted because I didn't deal with the source of the distraction itself, those internal triggers. So that's why we have to do these in order.
Do you have any issues with, you mentioned books, and I'm one of these people that, I'm sure you listen to podcasts and you get recommendations for books all the time, right? A friend will give you a book, or you'll hear something on a podcast and you pick it up either on Audible or you buy a copy of it for your Kindle. Do you go start to finish on a single book and then go on to the next one? Or do you find yourself hopping around and having just like a handful of books that you're reading all at the same time?
So I tend to hop around. And in fact, if a book isn't super engaging, I dump it pretty quick. And that's a behavior I had to learn because to me, it was hard to stop reading a book midstream. I felt like I was not finishing my homework assignment. But then I realized I'm an adult. I don't, you know, and frankly, if an author hasn't done a great job of getting me interested in the topic, then they don't deserve my time and attention. And so I try and write the kind of books that people want to keep reading or keep listening to. So no, I don't necessarily finish every book I start.
Yeah. I'm just curious because I find myself jumping around so much between books, and it's not that they're bad books. It's just that I, you know, pick up another one and just all of a sudden start and I'm two chapters in, and then, oh yeah, I got to go back to that other one. And that's like a sort of another form of distraction that I have when it applies to, like, you know, plain books.
I think part of that is that a lot of books are full of filler. You know, we see a lot, especially in the business self-help genre, they're filled with flowery stories and, you know, research studies that take 20 pages to explain. And, you know, that's not the kind of book I write. I was an entrepreneur two times. I know how little time most entrepreneurs have. And so I wanted, you know, every chapter ends with a summary where you can just scan the bullet points of what the chapter says. And if you want, you can go back and understand, you know, with more depth. So it was really important to me that you can jump around my book. So what I suggest, at least with the books I write, you know, if you scan the table of contents, you see the parts that look most interesting, and it's okay to jump around. You know, for example, the second half of my book has a section on how to build an indistractable workplace, how to raise indistractable kids, how to be an indistractable lover. So if those are areas that are like, oh man, you know what, my wife and I have been really fighting about why we can't put away these devices, maybe you want to jump straight to that section. And so that's kind of the type of book I try and write, because, you know, look, it's a gift that the reader is giving me their time, and you know, they it's an honor that someone would spend a few hours, you know, learning from what I've written. So I want to make that as easy as possible to digest.
Have you tested this out on? I love everything that you've said today. I think there's a lot. I'm excited to go, and you gave me the PDF. I want to get a hard copy of it, though, because I'd like to take notes. Yeah. But I want to actually apply this and see how it works out for me, because this has been a serious issue I've had to deal with. How many people did you test this out with when you were writing this book? Did you have like beta testers or friends and family?
Yeah. You know, let's see, it was over 24 people who have tried various techniques, some of them unsuccessfully. I mean, I didn't include any of the techniques that didn't work. I tried many techniques on myself and with other people. I have several profiles of people in the book. And a lot of the conventional wisdom out there doesn't work. Or if it, even the stuff that does work, if it's not done in the appropriate order, can actually be harmful, can actually backfire. One of the most surprising things that I learned in writing this book is how important mindset is. That, you know, there's this pervasive myth out there that informs a lot of self-help advice around what's called the ego depletion. Ego depletion is this idea that willpower is a reserve. That you have a gas tank of willpower and you run out of that willpower. And so this is why people say, oh, you know, morning rituals are super important because you run out of willpower. So, you know, you have to do this stuff in this, you know, have to do your most important stuff first and foremost because you're going to be dead by the end of the day. And there is some truth to that, but not in the way people think. So this, just to, it's such a fascinating story. Is it okay if I explain the ego depletion myth?
Yeah, oh, I'm really curious. Yeah, but yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
It's so interesting. So it turns out that this idea had some testing back. There was a professor by the name of Roy Baumeister at Florida State University who did some studies around ego depletion. But then a few other psychologists started to question whether this was real. And particularly there was some magical qualities that that Baumeister explained. For example, he showed that you could replenish willpower with sugar. So if you drank some lemonade sweetened with sugar in this experiment, your willpower was restored. Okay. And so this is why we hear a lot of popular myths of, you know, you need to replenish yourself. You need to, you know, if you drink some Gatorade or, you know, have a Coke, have a coffee, whatever, to reinvigorate yourself. And it turns out that ego depletion, these studies don't replicate, that they haven't replicated. There's been many psychologists that have tried to replicate these studies and they can't, except for one group of people. There was one group of people who actually we found is susceptible to ego depletion. And that group of people are the people who believe it's true.
Hmm.
So if you're the kind of person who believes, ugh, I'm spent, and this happened to me every night, I would come home after work and I say, oh, I've had a really hard day. I deserve some ice cream. I deserve to sit on the couch and, you know, watch some Netflix because I'm spent. So if you believe that you are spent, if you believe that your willpower is exhausted, it becomes true. Whereas the people in the studies who didn't necessarily believe that had no such effect. And so I talk extensively about the book about how we need to reimagine our temperament. And this goes back to this idea we talked about earlier about why it's so dangerous to talk about technology like it's addictive, like it's hijacking our brain, because it literally makes it true if we believe that about ourselves.
Hmm. So let me ask you a question. So if someone's saying I'm spent, like I'm tired, like this is me in a nutshell. I'm just like, oh, I've had a long day. I don't want to cook dinner tonight. You know, the babies, the wife still want the babies. And I'm just like, you know, there's that pizza place. I could just like, I could order some pizza and it would be amazing. Right. And so like, I'm spent guy. What's the opposite of that? Is it someone that's saying I'm spent, but it's not going to, like, do they feel tired?
Yeah, this is a terrific question. So if willpower isn't a limited resource, what is it? And so there's a psychologist by the name of Inslich who described willpower, instead of it being a depletable resource, it's actually an emotion. And so we wouldn't say, ooh, I was happy for a while and then I ran out of happy, right? We wouldn't say I was sad and then I ran out of sad. No, emotions are passing, right? So the idea is, how do we cope with these uncomfortable sensations, back to these internal triggers, so we can use various techniques to help us get through these uncomfortable sensations, like any internal trigger. So we can use various techniques. One that I use probably every day is called surfing the urge, where what we're doing when we feel this uncomfortable sensation, or we're about to get tempted to check our phones or order some pizza or do something we know we'll later regret, we spend a few minutes surfing the urge, understanding what it is that we're feeling. And one rule that I use all the time is called the 10-minute rule, where I can give in to that temptation, whether it's eating a piece of chocolate cake I know I'll regret later, or checking my phone or Instagram or whatever when I didn't plan to. I can give in to that temptation in 10 minutes.
I hate that, because then I'm not going to do it.
So those are.
If I wait 10 minutes, then I won't. You're screwing me here, because I do like to have that pint of ice cream.
Yeah, yeah. And look, there's nothing wrong with that. Again, there's nothing evil about ice cream. If you've planned for that ice cream, and that's part of exactly what you want to do with intent, that's terrific. Enjoy, right? Like, that's what life's for. I'm not, you know, telling everybody to be a prude here. Instead, what I'm advocating for is to not let the ice cream control you, is to not use it. You know, this is what happened to me, and this was the reason I was clinically obese, is that I didn't really want the ice cream. What I wanted was to not feel something. What I wanted was a bit of escape.
Right.
And so that indulgence gave me that escape. And it was a need for control over my life, you know, that I didn't have control in other areas of my life. And so the one thing I could control was what I put in my body. And so even if I wasn't hungry, I mean, how many times a day do we eat when we're not even hungry? We eat because we're fearful of being hungry, right? We eat because we're bored. We eat because we're tired. We eat for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with actual nourishment.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, that's one of the things that I like your idea of the 10-minute policy. I'm gonna try that one. I've tried that actually with making purchases as well. It's a really good thing when, you know, you're on Amazon or you're on some other site and you've added something to your cart and you're like, I may have it in 2 days. Yeah. Really tempting, you know, free shipping, all the reasons you tell yourself. If you just let that sit there, even for a day, you know, and you come back to it, you realize I don't really need that thing, you know, and you could just. And I think that's really powerful.
Exactly. And just to be clear, that's one technique that we're using in conjunction. If you just do that, it's likely to not work. But if you do that in conjunction with making time for traction. So if you know you don't want to order that pizza at night, not only are you dealing with the internal triggers, the most important stuff, step, but you're also making time for traction. So you have an alternative at home that you've made time on your calendar to not only prepare, but to also eat. Right. So a great way to prevent you from ordering the pizza is going to be to have a healthy meal ready and then removing the external triggers, right? Hacking back the external triggers. How can you make it a little bit, remove those external triggers from even popping up, right? Maybe you don't have the frozen pizza in your fridge or the other unhealthy food in your house. So you remove the external triggers and then you can use packs, right? You can prevent distraction by maybe having some kind of effort pact or price pact or identity pact, where you become the kind of person who just doesn't eat those kind of things. So one of the reasons we see, you know, every few years, a new fad identity, today it's keto or Whole30 or whatever, you know, whatever latest diet craze is called, part of it has to do with the diet, but let's face it, they all basically say the same thing. It's really about calories in, calories out. And I know I'm going to get hate mail of, you know, the keto people telling me this or the vegetarians telling me that, whatever. It's essentially, you know, in a nutshell, really about the same thing. But there's something super powerful about the identity. Why? Because when I say to somebody else, oh, I'm keto, or I'm vegetarian, or I'm vegan, or I'm kosher, I am reinforcing my own identity. And that's super, super powerful. So it turns out that teaching others, and there's been various studies that show this, that the reason that every major religion has proselytizing as part of the commandments that adherents are supposed to do, it's not just about recruiting others into the fold. It's about reinforcing the identity of the believer, because that helps us stick to these commandments. And so we can use the exact same techniques to avoid distraction.
Is it possible to make packs that are time-based? Meaning I tell myself, you know, I limit myself to 3 glasses of alcohol per week. And I say, okay, on Fridays when it's date night with my wife, I'm going to go out and I can have 2 drinks. Like, is that it? But I time bound to say only on Friday. I mean, yeah, I could do that with pizza too. I could say only once a week, this particular night, or does that work or no?
I think it's fantastic. Again, it's with intent. I think that's wonderful. If you say to yourself, look, given everything I know, given my values, it has to start with your values fundamentally. And values are defined as the attributes of the person we want to become. If you say to yourself, I want to become the kind of person who eats pizza once a week, that's terrific. It's wonderful. The idea, there's nothing evil about pizza. There's just like there's nothing evil about Instagram. It's about doing these things with intent when you want to, as opposed to when some corporation wants you to do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been fascinating stuff, and I'm excited to get that hard copy of the book so I can go through and make a ton of notes.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on, and yeah, we'll have to have you back and chat more about this once I get a full system in place, because this is something I certainly want to implement.
Absolutely. I would love to hear how it works out for you. And if, you know, I loved working with you on email. If there's other distractions that we can work through, that sounds great. We can make you a little case study here.
Very cool. Well, thanks for your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. That is it for this episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. I'd appreciate it. And that will allow us to get recommended to more people inside of iTunes and get more viewers, and then in turn have even better guests on the show. Thanks so much.